A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a heavy one. He's describing what happened in the final days of the Knesset, before it dissolved itself in late June as a democratic catastrophe. And he's not being dramatic. The outgoing government passed a rapid-fire series of four laws. A Haredi draft exemption law that includes criminal immunity for draft dodgers. A media law creating a government-friendly oversight committee that looks like it was photocopied from Viktor Orban's Hungary playbook. A rabbinate monopoly law that reverses a 2023 reform and restores sole kosher certification authority to the chief rabbinate. And the big one, a law constraining the attorney general's power and effectively neutering judicial review. Daniel's question is blunt. Is there any undo button on this? Because to his mind, reasoning logically, a military coup looks like the only viable option. He's not endorsing it, but he wants to know if there's a less dramatic path back.
We got our first real data point on whether there is one just yesterday. July 16th, the High Court of Justice froze implementation of the law banning arrest of Haredi draft dodgers, issued an interim injunction. This is the first test of whether the judicial review abolition actually worked as intended, and the court's answer was, essentially, not so fast.
Which is either reassuring or terrifying, depending on how you read it. Reassuring because the court is still asserting itself. Terrifying because we're now in uncharted territory where the court and the Knesset are directly testing each other's limits in real time, with no formal constitution to adjudicate who wins.
Let's lay out exactly what happened in that final Knesset session, because the sequencing is everything. This wasn't a random grab bag of legislation, it was a tactical sequence.
Walk me through it.
Four laws, passed in rapid succession before the Knesset dissolved itself in late June, creating a caretaker government that cannot pass new legislation until after the election. Law 1, the Haredi Draft Exemption Law. This doesn't just exempt yeshiva students from military service. It includes a provision banning the arrest of draft dodgers. Law 2, the media law. It creates a preferential framework for a pro-government news outlet and establishes a media oversight committee modeled on Hungary's Media Council, the body Orbán's Fidesz party used after 2010 to consolidate control over broadcast media. Law 3, the rabbinate monopoly law. This reverses a 2023 reform that had opened kosher certification to private competitors, restoring sole authority to the chief rabbinate. Law 4, the Attorney General Constraint Law. This limits the AG's power to represent the state in court and restricts standing for petitioners who want to challenge basic laws.
The tactical logic is, pass the laws that would normally get struck down, then pass the law that cripples the mechanism for striking them down, all before the caretaker constraint kicks in.
The Knesset dissolved itself, so the government is now in caretaker mode. No new legislation can be passed until after the next election, but the laws already passed remain in effect unless they're struck down or repealed. It's a legislative minefield laid right before the door locks.
The Orban playbook isn't a rhetorical flourish either. I mean, the Media Oversight Committee is practically a direct import. Hungary's Media Council, established under Fidesz's 2010 media law, was staffed entirely by party loyalists and given the power to levy massive fines against outlets that didn't toe the line. It didn't shut down opposition media directly. It made operating them financially unsustainable.
That's the sophistication of the approach. It's not a blunt instrument, it's a slow squeeze. The oversight committee can issue fines, revoke licenses, impose content requirements, all in the name of regulatory standards. The pro-government outlet preference is the other side of the same coin. You make life difficult for everyone else while giving your preferred outlet favorable treatment, advertising access, distribution advantages. Over time, the media landscape tilts.
The laws themselves are bad enough, but Daniel's real question is about the undo button, and that hinges on the fourth law, the AG constraint. What exactly does it do?
Two main things. First, it limits the Attorney General's power to represent the state in court. Traditionally, the AG is the government's lawyer, but also an independent legal authority. The AG can refuse to defend laws the government passes if they're unconstitutional. This law constrains that independence. Second, it restricts standing for petitioners challenging basic laws. Standing is the legal doctrine that determines who can bring a case to court. By narrowing standing, you reduce the pool of people who can challenge legislation, which means fewer cases reach the high court at all.
You've narrowed the pipeline, and you've handcuffed the government's own lawyer from saying, "This law is indefensible."
And that's why the July 16th freeze on the draft law is so significant. The High Court issued an interim injunction despite these new constraints, which means the court is asserting jurisdiction. It's saying, "We still have the power to review this, regardless of what the new law says."
This is where the absence of a formal constitution really starts to matter. Because in a country with a codified entrenched constitution, the court's authority to review legislation is explicit. It's in the document. Israel doesn't have that. What it has is a set of basic laws that the court has treated as quasi-constitutional since the 1995 Mizrahi Bank ruling.
Case 6821/93. This is the foundational ruling. The court, led by then-President Aharon Barak, established that basic laws have constitutional status and that the court can review Knesset legislation against them. It was a judicial innovation, not something explicitly written anywhere. The argument was that the Knesset wears two hats. When it passes ordinary legislation, it's a legislature. When it passes basic laws, it's a constitutional assembly. And the court can review ordinary legislation against the constitutional standard set by basic laws.
Which was always a bit of a legal fiction. The Knesset is the same body either way. But it worked for 3 decades because everyone more or less accepted the framework.
The new AG constraint law is a direct challenge to that framework. It's the Knesset saying, "We reject the Mizrahi Bank doctrine. We are not a constitutional assembly. We are a sovereign parliament, and our laws are not subject to judicial review."
The High Court's freeze on July 16th is essentially the court saying, "We reject your rejection." Which sets up a constitutional crisis where both sides claim the other is acting illegitimately.
This is where the comparison to Hungary is instructive, but also limited. Orbán's Fidesz faced a similar situation after their 2010 electoral victory. They had a supermajority, they passed a new constitution, the 2011 fundamental law, and they restructured the judiciary. But the critical difference is that they packed the constitutional court with loyalists first. They expanded the court from 11 to 15 judges and filled the new seats with Fidesz appointees. Israel's court hasn't been packed. The current justices were appointed under the old system, and they have tenure.
The court still has teeth, and it just bit. But here's what I keep coming back to. Daniel's prompt describes this as a democratic catastrophe, and he's wrestling with a genuinely unsettling paradox. A democratically elected parliament has voted to enshrine an illiberal system into law. The majority wanted this, or at least the majority of the Knesset did. So is the court's intervention itself anti-democratic? Are we in a situation where the only thing standing between Israel and illiberal democracy is an unelected judiciary?
This is the tension at the heart of constitutional democracy everywhere, but it's especially acute in Israel because there's no constitutional text to anchor the argument. In the United States, you can point to Article 3 and say, "Judicial review is part of the design." In Germany, the basic law explicitly empowers the constitutional court. In Israel, you're pointing to a 30-year-old court ruling that interpreted the Knesset's own basic laws as a constitution. The Knesset never explicitly said was a constitution.
Which is why the AG constraint law is so clever. It doesn't say judicial review is abolished. It says, "We're limiting standing and constraining the AG." The court can still theoretically review laws, but the mechanism for getting cases before the court has been narrowed. It's death by 1,000 procedural motions.
That brings us to Daniel's military coup argument. Let's take it seriously, because he's not being flippant. He's reasoning from a premise. If the democratic process has been used to dismantle democratic checks, and the court's power to intervene has been constrained, and elections are months away while these laws are already in effect, then what mechanism remains to reverse course? His logical conclusion is that only extra democratic force, a military intervention, could do it.
Let's test that. What would an IDF coup actually look like?
It would require the IDF to disobey civilian authority. The IDF has never done this. Its leadership has explicitly and repeatedly ruled it out. The military's institutional culture is built on subordination to the elected government, full stop. A coup would require a complete break with that culture, and there's no indication any senior commander is considering it.
Even if someone were, the consequences would be catastrophic. The shekel would crater. Israel's international alliances, especially with the United States, would be severed or at least severely strained. And internally, you'd have civil conflict between secular and religious populations that makes the 2023 judicial reform protests look like a picnic.
The Haredi draft exemption law is the flashpoint here. The IDF is already struggling with personnel shortages. The exemption doesn't just create inequality, it creates a structural manpower crisis. If the military were to intervene in politics, the Haredi community would see it as a secular coup aimed at forcing their sons into uniform. That's not a political disagreement. That's a civil war scenario.
A coup isn't a solution. It's a different catastrophe. But that still leaves Daniel's question. What are the actual undo mechanisms?
Three paths, none of them easy. Path one is electoral. The next Knesset can repeal any of these laws by simple majority. 51 votes. That's it. No supermajority requirement, no constitutional amendment process. A simple majority. If the opposition wins the election and forms a government, they can undo everything in the first week of the new Knesset.
That's a big if. And the window matters. The election hasn't happened yet. These laws are in effect right now. The Media Oversight Committee can start operating. The rabbinate monopoly can be re-entrenched. The longer the laws stay in place before an election, the more irreversible the damage becomes.
The media law is the most time-sensitive. Once you've restructured the information environment, it becomes harder for opposition parties to win future elections. That's the ratchet effect. You tilt the playing field, then you win the next election because the field is tilted. Then you tilt it further. Hungary is the case study. By the time the opposition managed to organize effectively, Fidesz had so thoroughly captured the media landscape that fair elections were nearly impossible.
Path 1, elections, works in theory, but the clock is ticking and the ratchet is turning. What's path 2?
Path 2 is judicial. The High Court can strike down laws that violate basic laws, but only if it asserts jurisdiction despite the new AG constraint law. The July 16th freeze suggests it's willing to do that. The real test will be whether the court strikes down the AG constraint law itself. If the court rules that the constraint law violates basic constitutional principles, even though the law is designed to prevent exactly that kind of review, we're in a constitutional crisis.
Which is where Part 3 comes in. The Attorney General can refuse to defend the challenged laws in court. Even with the new constraints, the AG retains some independence. If the AG says, "I will not defend this law because it's unconstitutional," that creates a crisis that forces the government to either back down or find alternative legal representation. And if the government hires private counsel to defend the law, that itself becomes a political liability.
The AG constraint law tries to prevent this by limiting the AG's power, but it doesn't eliminate it entirely. The AG is still a statutory office with defined responsibilities. The question is whether the current AG is willing to test the limits of the new law by refusing to defend legislation she considers unconstitutional. That's a high-stakes gamble.
It's worth noting that the AG during the 2023 judicial reform crisis, Gali Baharav Miara, publicly opposed the government's efforts to constrain her office. She's still in the position. She's not a political appointee in the way a U.S. Attorney General is. She's a civil servant with tenure protections.
We have three paths, all of which are uncertain. Elections could reverse everything, but might come too late. The court could strike down the laws, but might be overruled or ignored. The AG could refuse to cooperate, but might be sidelined. None of these are clean. All of them involve some form of institutional confrontation.
Which brings me to the deeper structural problem that Daniel's prompt exposes. Israel has been running a 75-year experiment in unwritten constitutionalism, and it's now reached its stress test. The absence of a codified, entrenched constitution means that a simple Knesset majority can alter the fundamental rules of the game. This isn't a bug that just appeared. It's been the design all along.
The UK comparison is instructive here. The UK also has no codified constitution and operates on parliamentary sovereignty. In theory, Parliament can do anything. But the UK has centuries of convention, a robust committee system, a professional civil service, and an upper house, the House of Lords, that can delay legislation. Israel has none of those things. It's a unicameral parliament with weak committees, coalition governments that are inherently unstable, and a proportional representation system that gives small parties outsized leverage.
The UK also has a monarch who, at least in theory, could refuse royal assent. That's never been tested in modern times, but the reserve power exists. Israel doesn't have anything equivalent. The president is a ceremonial figure. There's no upper house. There's no federal structure that divides power. When a Knesset majority wants something, there are very few veto points.
Which is why the basic law innovation was so important. It created a judicial veto point where none existed. But the weakness of that innovation is that it was always vulnerable to a determined Knesset majority that decided to simply reject the court's authority. That's what's happening now.
Let's talk about the knock-on effect, because the legal mechanism is only half the story. The Hardy draft exemption law, if it stands, fundamentally changes the IDF's personnel structure and the social contract between secular and religious Israelis. This isn't just about fairness. It's about whether the military can function.
The IDF relies on reserve duty. The model is a small standing army backed by a large reserve force that can be mobilized quickly. If a growing portion of the population is exempt from service, the burden falls disproportionately on the secular and national religious populations. Reserve duty gets longer. Careers get disrupted more frequently. This social compact that says everyone serves, everyone sacrifices, starts to fray.
The media law creates a state-captured information environment. Once the oversight committee is staffed and operational, it can start issuing fines and content requirements. Opposition outlets face financial pressure. Investigative journalism becomes riskier. The public sphere shrinks. And because this happens gradually, through regulatory pressure rather than outright censorship, it's harder to mobilize against. There's no single dramatic moment. Just a slow dimming.
The Rabbinate Monopoly Law is subtler, but maybe more insidious in the long run. The 2023 reform that opened kosher certification to private competitors was a genuine liberalization. It broke the chief rabbinate's stranglehold on a core aspect of daily life for observant Jews. Restoring that monopoly doesn't just reverse a reform, it re-entrenches religious authority over civil life. Marriage, divorce, conversion, burial, kosher food. All of these remain under rabbinic control. The more that control expands, the harder it is to build a liberal civil society.
These three laws interact. The Haredi community gets draft exemptions and reinforced rabbinic authority. The secular majority gets a captured media environment that makes it harder to organize politically. The liberal coalition locks in its advantages across multiple dimensions simultaneously.
There's an irony here that's worth pointing out. The caretaker government's tactical brilliance may be its undoing. By passing so many controversial laws so quickly, in such a compressed time frame, they've created a very clear electoral choice. The election won't be fought on vague promises. It'll be fought on four specific laws that voters can evaluate. Do you want the Haredi draft exemption? Do you want the Media Oversight Committee? Do you want the Rabbinate Monopoly? Do you want the neutered judiciary?
That's the optimistic read. The pessimistic read is that the media law will make it harder for the opposition to communicate that choice to voters, and the rabbinate law will mobilize religious voters who benefit from the monopoly, and the draft exemption law will be defended as protecting Torah study, which has genuine cultural resonance even among some non-Haredi voters.
Both reads can be true. The question is, which dynamic is stronger? And we won't know until the election.
If a coup isn't the answer, and the court's response is uncertain, and the election is the main event, what should people actually watch for in the coming weeks?
First, the High Court's next move on the draft law freeze. The July 16th ruling was an interim injunction. The court will need to rule on the merits. If it strikes down the draft exemption law, that's a direct confrontation with the Knesset's claim that judicial review is dead. Second, watch for the AG's response. If she refuses to defend any of the four laws, that triggers a crisis that forces the caretaker government to either back down or escalate. Third, watch the Media Oversight Committee. If it starts issuing fines or making personnel decisions before the election, that's a sign the ratchet is already turning.
For citizens, the most effective pressure point is the election campaign itself. International attention, domestic protest, and legal challenges all feed into the electoral calculus. The question is whether the opposition can credibly promise to restore the pre-July 2026 status quo, and whether voters believe them.
The 2023 judicial reform protests are the relevant precedent here. Hundreds of thousands of Israelis took to the streets for months. The protests didn't stop the legislation entirely, but they created enough political pressure that the government eventually paused the overhaul. The question now is whether that energy can be remobilized, and whether it can translate into electoral outcomes.
The difference is that in 2023, the protest was against a proposed reform. Now the laws have actually passed. The fight has shifted from prevention to reversal, which is psychologically different. It's harder to mobilize against something that's already happened than against something that might happen.
Which brings us back to the fundamental question Daniel raised. Can a democracy vote itself out of being a democracy? The term he used, illiberal democracy, is precise. The laws preserve elections. You still get to vote. But they remove the liberal checks that protect minority rights, rule of law, and an independent public sphere. You get the form of democracy without the substance.
That's the paradox. If a majority votes for a liberal democracy, is the result democratic? By process, yes. By substance, no. The process produced an outcome that undermines the process. It's a snake eating its own tail.
The philosopher Karl Popper called this the paradox of tolerance. A tolerant society that tolerates the intolerant eventually ceases to be tolerant. The same logic applies to democracy. A democratic system that democratically empowers those who would dismantle democratic checks eventually ceases to be democratic in any meaningful sense.
Daniel's instinct that a military coup is the only logical solution reveals how desperate the situation looks from inside. When the democratic process has been used to dismantle democratic checks and the remaining institutions are under assault, it's natural to look for some external force that can hit the reset button. But the High Court's freeze on the draft law shows that the system still has fight left.
The next 90 days will determine whether Israel's democratic institutions can save themselves. The election is the main event, but the court rulings, the AG's decisions, and the media environment in the run-up to the vote will shape whether that election is free and fair.
One more thing worth flagging. The international dimension. Israel's relationships with the United States and Europe have already been strained by the judicial overhaul. If the media law creates a visibly captured information environment, and the draft exemption law creates a visible inequality in military service, and the rabbinate law creates visible religious coercion, the pressure from allies will intensify. That matters because Israel depends on those relationships for trade, security coordination, and diplomatic cover.
Though I'd caution against over-relying on international pressure. Hungary's Fidesz has weathered years of EU criticism and Article 7 proceedings without losing domestic support. Orbán turned external criticism into a political asset. We're defending Hungarian sovereignty against Brussels bureaucrats. The same playbook is available here. We're defending Israeli sovereignty against foreign interference.
Where does that leave us? The undo button exists, but it's not a button. It's a sequence of institutional confrontations that all have to go right, in a compressed time frame, against an opponent that designed the sequence specifically to make reversal difficult. The election is the cleanest path, but the media environment is being tilted before the vote. The court is the most immediate check, but its authority is being challenged. The AG is a potential circuit breaker, but her powers have been constrained.
That's the honest answer to Daniel's question. There is no single undo button. There's a constellation of pressure points, all of which are uncertain, all of which interact, and all of which require citizens to stay engaged through a process that's been deliberately designed to exhaust them.
The user's prompt ends with a question about whether an election is the only democratic way to counter what's happened. The answer is yes, but with an asterisk. The election is the only legitimate mechanism for reversal. But the legitimacy of the election itself depends on whether the media law and the other changes have tilted the playing field so far that the outcome is predetermined. If the election is free and fair, and the illiberal coalition wins again, then Israel has made a democratic choice for a liberal democracy. That's a tragedy, but it's not a coup. If the election is not free and fair, then Daniel's darker reasoning starts to look more prescient.
That's the question to sit with, not whether the undo button exists, but whether the conditions for pressing it are still in place. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, French naturalist Philibert Commerson observed a male blanket octopus off the coast of Mauritius ripping off the venomous tentacle of a Portuguese man-o-war and wielding it as a defensive weapon against a pursuing dolphin, essentially turning one predator's arsenal against another. The dolphin backed off.
The octopus was doing geopolitics before we were. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own questions, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everything, even if we can't get to all of it on air. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumintop. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.